what you just heard was a small part of a song which my guest is part of the band. And not only is he part of the band, he's also manager and rehearsed the whole songs. And he has something he does in his spare time, which you have never probably heard of, which is kind of very, very interesting and necessary to do. And I'm really excited that he's with us. Welcome, Kevin Tangney. How's it going?
Oh, it's great. Thank you for having me on.
And today, sorry, I forgot to tell, like, welcome back to Inspiringly Different, my friends out there. It's Luca again. And today we're going from Germany to Phoenix, Arizona, to right to the Mexican-American border. Is this so?
Yeah.
Kevin, you are, as I said, you are playing in a band, but that's not why we are, not the most part why we are meeting today, is it?
No, I mean, yeah, originally I think we had gotten into contact because of my work down by the border. I'm a part of an organization called the Battalion Search and Rescue, and we search in wilderness areas north of the U.S.-Mexico border for human remains of migrants that have perished trying to come into the United States in order to bring closure to their families.
So it's, you're living in Phoenix, that's on the border, and there's a huge desert there, right?
Yeah, Phoenix. I think Phoenix is a few hundred miles north of the border. So we travel down in areas. We typically work within 50 miles of the border. So the last search we went on, we started a mile and a half from the border. Other searches we've been on, we've started 40 miles away from the border. Mm-hmm. And typically, the migrant's journey is when they're walking in is typically between 20 and 50 miles.
So they, and you are, when you go out there, you are with your team, like, or you're part of the team, and you go with one or two trucks, or I don't know, and you drive there, and then you hop off and walk, or how's it normally going?
Yeah, so we normally meet up at a gas station somewhere at like 0600, like 6 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And then we all hop into a couple of trucks, and then we drive out like on a highway until we hit a dirt road, and we drive for, you know, usually several miles on the dirt road. And then we find our spot where we're going to start hiking. We get out, we have a little briefing, and then, yeah, we start walking.
You start walking, and you are searching a particular area. And as you just said, the main purpose is to search for refugees, immigrants, migrants who are past the border already, who are already in America, in the United States.
Correct.
And I mean, they are, you said that this was the thing that really caught me when we had our conversation, because I thought you are going to search like for living people who are there and who need your help, like you need water or food or supplies in any kind. But when we talked, you said that mainly that most likely never happens, like that you meet, like,
yeah, it's rare. It's going to happen. It hasn't happened yet with this group. Typically people who are trying to cross are not interested in running into anybody else. That includes the mm-hmm. migrants and the coyotes. The coyotes are their guides. So all the routes are controlled and managed by the cartels. And
the Mexican cartels.
Yeah, the Mexican cartels, yeah. And they're certainly not interested in running into us or anybody because mm-hmm. of the fear of getting deported, the migrants' fear of getting caught, and then mm-hmm. and then the cartel's fear of you know law enforcement actions being taken. So you know, of course, we carry extra water with us always, just in case we run into someone. Extra water and food. You know, the legality of that is somewhat questionable, which is I think a travesty. For instance, I know that one of the areas that we search the employees of that land management company are not allowed to assist migrants. So if they come across migrants and they're really? Not and the employees aren't law enforcement, they'll lose their job if they assist these people. Which,
really?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that from an employee that works at this land management and agency, and I don't really want to name this land management agency because we do a lot of work there and we don't want to get it shut down. But this land management agency, there's lots of tourists that go to this place and they're hiking around. And of course, you know, when if a quote tourist needed help, the employees, you know, are pretty much obligated to assist. Yeah. But if you know, if you have a different color skin and maybe you look like you might not be, they're not allowed to assist. Like they'll lose their jobs. And it's inhumane and pretty racist, really. And I just mentioned that because of the legality of helping people out. Long story short, we're always ready to assist anybody that we find out there who is alive, but it's pretty rare that we find someone that's alive.
So Kevin, you're telling me there are people in this area working there like a normal job or whatever, and they are forbidden by law that when they see someone who is obviously not a tourist on a hike, but a person who really needs help, needs water, needs food or shoes, I don't know, whatever, just needs to survive, they are not allowed to help them and they could lose their job when they throw a bottle of water to them? Like,
yeah, I'm not certain it's law, but it's at least what was communicated to me by the employee. It's policy.
Yeah, but even if it's communicated or it's policy, I mean that's tough.
Yeah, no, it's inhumane.
Inhumane is even a better word for it. I mean, imagine the situation: you are out there working, like your normal job, and there's someone coming or people coming and they really need help or just need water. They're starving and you're standing there like, yeah, listen, I can't give you anything. I'll lose my job and that's everything I got here. I'm otherwise my family, I can't feed my family. And what kind of choice is that?
And it's even more, these people's job is to, part of their job is to assist people
with the tourists.
On their land. Yeah. So it's
that's just ridiculous.
Yeah. All because, you know, they might suspect that someone crossed an imaginary line.
So you're going out there with your team, with your trucks, and then you go for a hike. what's normally happening on a normal day when you're doing this? Like, you are out there for how many hours, and how many hours hiking? Like a whole day?
Typically, so we do single day searches, and we do multi-day searches. A single day search is we typically do about 10 miles. I think that's like 16 kilometers.
Yeah. Yeah. 1.6. And
yeah. And then, for multi-day searches, like an overnight search, we'll do 20 to 25 miles. Typically they last all day or all of both days. It's not, you know, it's not, we're not walking very fast because we're searching. It's not a hike. And we're doing a lot of, bushwhacking. So trying to, and everything out here wants to hurt you. Whether it's the, you know, the
it's
animals,
like Australia,
the rattlesnakes and right. Yeah. Or, and like, even like all the trees, I mean, there's just thorns everywhere. And it's, so it's pretty slow going. You know, it's just funny. I like bought a new pair of like heavy duty work pants maybe a month and a half ago. And like right before I got on the podcast, I was like, oh, I'm going to have to buy another pair because they're just starting to get ripped up to shreds already.
Oh, my God.
It's real slow going. We typically get back to the vehicles around. We'll start walking around 7 o'clock in the morning. We'll typically get back around 4 or 5 in the okay. afternoon, early evening.
Whole working day.
If we do a single day, and then, you know, of course, multi-day, we'll depart at 7 in the morning. We'll get back around 4 or 5 the mm-hmm. next day.
So you go out there, you search the bushes, the bushwork, and then for signs of like human remains, bottles.
Yeah.
Any signs?
So there, most of the searches that we've been on, we've found remains. But every single search we've been on, there's just evidence of migration all over the place. Migrants carry these gallon black water jugs, ostensibly for so they don't reflect at night. So they're like sort of camouflaged. There's a lot of camouflage clothing and backpacks that we find. And it's just like food packaging, just every, I mean, yeah, we found, I mean, the sort of the saddest thing we found, typically is shoes. We find a lot of pairs of shoes and, you know, when you still have 30 miles to walk and you leave behind your shoes out in the desert, it's just, I can't imagine those people making it, you know? And of course, when we see that, we stop and we search that
area,
that whole, you know, localized area. An unfortunate and surprising amount of shoes that we find.
Wow. So they're, I mean, they, I can't think of a scenario where someone leaves their shoes and it's not with someone ending up like dead. It could be either someone died and he took the shoes and carried them with him until they weren't good anymore. But wow, I mean, it's desert, it's hot in the night, it's cold, and as you said, like, everything wants to kill you. I guess there are probably snakes, insects, scorpions, like whatever you can imagine. And walking barefoot, I mean, that doesn't sound like that doesn't sound like something someone would do who
is it, like, has all their mental capabilities.
And
you know, when I was, you know, we talked earlier about a few other jobs I've had. When I was guiding, in Moab, Utah, whitewater river trips and hiking trips and 4x4 trips, you know, we would always press upon our customers the need to stay hydrated, because we would say like 98% of everything that goes wrong out here is because of dehydration. Mm-hmm. People just stop making good choices when they're dehydrated. And who knows about the shoe thing? Like, if maybe they're just, maybe they brought extra pair of shoes and they were like,
yeah, right.
No,
right.
I don't want to carry this weight anymore. Or maybe, they were as their way of payment to the cartels to come across was to be a drug mule. We've heard stories of that not working out well, where the mules are stop getting along with the coyotes, and then the coyotes execute the drug mules. Who knows? Maybe like we were saying, if you get so dehydrated that you just start making, you know, really choices. Really terrible choices. Yeah,
and you maybe don't even, you're so full of pain that you don't even care if it's like barefoot. Okay, I just care. I don't care anymore.
Yeah, I have no idea. It's just horrific.
Oh my god. I mean, have you? I mean, it's sad to find shoes and to find these water bottles and backpacks or whatever. But that's not everything you find. I mean, you go out there, as you said, to search for living people. So far, you haven't encountered any. But what you have found already, and most of the times, are like human remains.
Correct.
Like bones and stuff, like bodies.
Right.
That's tough. I mean, you see dead people every time you go to your work, or mostly.
Yeah, I think the hardest one was we found a small arm bone next to a child's backpack. And that was pretty rough. I don't even let my head go to what that scenario is. You know, sometimes we try and like piece together maybe what happened. But that one, I can't let my mind go there. 'Cause that, you know, some choices were made, and some impossible choices must have been made, and I can't, it just doesn't compute. Sorry about that. It just doesn't compute.
Yesterday I recorded a podcast with Jean-Marc Dubov. He's in the Victoria local government in Canada, and he was a refugee for over 20 years. So he came from Somalia, and he talked about when he was 8 years old, the civil war started in Somalia, and from one day to another, his childhood was over. Right. Just was over. It wasn't anymore. No normal life for the next 20 years.
Yep.
And he said he knows, he can remember the day, the night more pretty good, when his mother took him and his oldest sister, so not everybody from the family, only him and his oldest sister, and put them on a boat to Kenya. Like a few days boat trip with also coyotes, they call them different there, but mm-hmm. a boat overloaded by hundreds of people. And I mean, he was 8 years old, and he told me like off the script that people didn't make it. I mean, and in the camp also, yeah. And It was actually Mother's Day when we recorded, so I didn't want to ask him why his mother chose him and his sister and not every... I mean, they came afterwards, but at first you have to say like, okay, I just send these two and then the other. But as you said, it's... That's since I recorded a podcast yesterday, this is hunting me because I can't imagine what drives a person to, first of all, leave your country and go on a way that will probably kill you, but it's better than being at home because right. home will eventually kill you.
Right.
And how hard it must be to send your children, like to send them on their way without you. And because, wow, man, how do you do that, man? I'm just struggling with imagining it, but. Wow. Whoosh. I'm sorry.
No, I... Yeah, it's...
I mean, it's so... What I don't understand is why is it such a big deal? I mean, they are not coming because they want to. I mean, they are forced to come. I mean...
Right.
Would you leave your country? I mean, I suppose everybody who's born in their country and it's a stable country... You love your country. You don't want to leave.
Right.
You love your home country. You don't want to leave. Something has to happen that you take this journey onto. And then to say, yeah, it's nice that you walked like for thousands of kilometers, that you left your family back and that probably you've seen a lot of death happening and maybe your children died, but you have to go back. Like, wow. I mean, you have to be a special kind of person to say that.
I don't think like person describes it. I don't have. Let me say this. I hope that I have more in common with the people trying to come this way through this country than the people trying to stop them.
I saw a few days ago.
I used to be one of the, you know. One of the people that would have tried to stop them, you know, I wasn't working with Border Patrol, but I, you know, I was, when I was deployed to Iraq with the US Army, it's that same mentality where you dehumanize people, and you create an us and them and their lives don't matter as much as other lives. As part of the reason why I do this work is to try and, I don't know, make up for my time in Iraq, is some sort of, you know, I can't offer any kind of, real apology to those people, to the Iraqis. So I try and, you know, try and become a better person and help other people out this way.
When you say you didn't, you dehumanize them.
Yeah.
What? How would you describe? How would you describe this? That how can you dehumanize someone? Because from also not imaginable for me.
Yeah, it's unfortunately it's really easy.
Oh.
And you know. I think in order to get massive amounts of people to point guns at other people, you need to develop systems that propagandize your people in order to do that. And you know, militaries around the world have been doing that for centuries, you know.
Yeah, right.
And it's the only way that you can fight a war is to dehumanize the other people. And, you know, from calling, like we called, unfortunately, and I hate to admit this, but when we were in Iraq, we called the Iraqis Haji. That was like the nickname. And, you know, that's one way. And another way is this idea of us versus them, and I'm coming home at the end of the day, no matter what. And my battle buddy is too. Again, that's a necessary part of war. But it's unfortunate because to do that, it automatically means you need to, if you want to win, you have to dehumanize the people and the population. Yeah. And that's what's happening along this border. Whether it's propaganda, they're going to take all our jobs, or they're going to, you know, tax the system, or they're going to come here and rape your daughter, or, they're bringing drugs in, or they're going to change the United States culture. All of this stuff is in an effort to dehumanize and set up this us versus them system. And so and when you constantly hear that, and your entire culture is based on this idea too of an American exceptionalism, it creates a recipe for the disaster that people are facing now.
What you describe sounds familiar, unfortunately. It sounds very familiar with the big wave of refugees we had in 2015. Right. 2014, 2015, right. Where everybody was a lot of Germans were concerned. I don't think a lot of Germans were concerned, but the media pushed it, like the few who were concerned were like, it's all over the media. And so
right.
The German has fear from the foreigner from the far, far away land, from Somalia and whatever, because they are coming to steal our wives and steal our jobs. And they will change our German culture for everything. It's interesting that it's the same in your country. And if it's the same in your country at the other side of the globe, then it's probably the same in other countries. And it sounds like kind of a system to make this, to put a target on someone's head. And say,
yeah, on the others.
Yeah, you should be afraid of him, because if you are afraid of him, you have no time to think about what we are doing behind your backs to gain more money or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like, if they spent a quarter of the money like helping these people than they did preventing these people from coming over. Like, you know, it just, the math doesn't work out. Like,
no. Yeah. And it's also, Shamake yesterday told me, if the people are coming, you can't stop them. I mean, if they want to come, they're coming. And if they're coming hundreds of thousands because the conditions in the country is so bad, they're coming. And if there are millions, they're coming. And you can build up walls as high as you want.
Yeah.
They are coming, so you should do something, change something beforehand.
It's almost, I don't know if this is a good analogy. This might be a terrible analogy, but it's almost like a supply and demand issue. Even just like the whole, they're coming to like take our jobs and they're, you know, whatever. If there's a demand for cheap labor, there's always going to be a supply, right? It's just where there's a will, there's a way. And, there's stories of we hear that already with this fucking wall of people, cartels like cutting holes in the wall and then like, replacing, there are these like huge like steel bars that are sunk into the ground. They'll cut holes into them and then they'll like replace, they'll like put them back into place and then they'll paint over it. And so the next time they want to come up, they just take a hammer and tink. And then the thing like comes out and it's just like, Gosh. That whole fucking thing is a multi-million-dollar vanity project for that orange asshole, you know, and his cult.
Yeah. Now he's first thing. First good thing is now he's not president anymore. So first good thing that happened. But I heard he wants to go again for the election in 2024.
Yeah, and 2025. And the crazy thing, he probably has a chance. You know, yeah,
man.
It's fascism is alive and well in America, and I'm not saying that it, you know, like Joe Biden. I mean, fuck Joe Biden all day long. You know, and you know he voted for the war. He's like not that much better than Trump, but you know there's a segment, a huge segment of the American population, and it seems like it's I don't know if it's spreading to the rest of the world because of him or whatever, but there seems to be this crazy fascist uprising, at least in the United States, and it seems like in other countries as well.
Germany,
I'm noticing, like in
France,
like neo-Nazis and over here it's like white nationalists, you know, and it's really like scary, because we're having to especially before Trump, these people were kind of, weren't out in front in the open. You could, I'm not saying you should ignore them, but it was easier to ignore them and kind of be like, you don't need to take them seriously. They're just a fringe element. But, you know, we saw over the last 4 years that he gave a platform to those people.
Yeah.
And now you have to deal with them seriously. I mean, they fucking tried to take over the Capitol, you know?
Wow. Yeah. Capitol Hill. I mean, that was crazy. That shocked the world. That shocked the world.
Yeah. It's all based on this like white nationalist mentality, and
it's, as you said, it's not only in America or in the US, it's also in Germany of a new party since a few years who was like right, far right, and who get voted into the parliament with more than 10%, and it's like in Germany, especially in Germany, that shouldn't happen, like never ever.
You guys have, like,
I mean, we fucked it up.
At least when I was living there, it really felt like you all had, like, and I don't know if you can ever come to terms with something like the Holocaust, but it felt like you had like it was such, I mean, I even think it's illegal to give that hand signal. Here in America, we haven't dealt with our Holocausts that way. You know, we have the slave trade and then what we did to the Native Americans. We haven't dealt with it in the same way that Germany's dealt with the Holocaust. And so it is like a little bit more surprising to see that stuff come up in Germany, you know, the seeds never seem to die. They just lay dormant.
No, they surely don't. Never. What also, I mean, last year we had, 75th anniversary of the end of Second World War in Germany. 1945 was the end of the World War, I guess. Yeah. And normally in Germany, there is not parades, but like, there are celebrations where, there are speakers, like often there are Jews, like Holocaust survivors. And they are always, I mean, they are over 80, 90, some of them are over 100. And one of the bad things I think is that the people who were there, they are dying. They are dying and they see this whole thing. And if you talk to, like, if you have great grandparents and if you talk to them about politics, they often are very, very concerned because they say, man, listen, I've seen this shit happen before, right. and it didn't work out very well for us, for the world, right. for no one. And why aren't we learning? I mean, why is it happening again? So huge. So okay, let's go back a little bit from politics. We really run into that. Kevin, one question that came up to my mind and probably to every person's mind is, you kind of mentioned it at the beginning, but why are you doing this job, or why is this an existing job? Because shouldn't the authorities, I mean, kind of do that, like look on their land and see, hey, there are like people dying on a constant basis, we should probably do something about it? And
well, right, I mean, they do that.
Okay.
I would say with white people who are American citizens.
Okay.
Right. So it's not like, we don't have the capabilities. We're already doing these, you know, law enforcement. I mean, if I went out missing in one of these wilderness areas, they would send everybody out to come find me, and it would make like national news and you know, all kinds of resources, because at the end of the day, to our government and these people, like, I matter more than these migrants do. And obviously. So, and I don't believe that's not my ideology. So, you know, when I heard about this group, said like a pretty elite group of outdoor professionals and people with experience and veterans. We go out and hike miles out in the desert, like looking for people who've perished. And I was like, well, that's right up my alley. And I feel like a responsibility, especially because it's like my exact my skill set, you know, the only thing I know how to do well in this world is walk for long distances, carrying a lot of my weight on my back through the desert. Right. And yeah, I just feel a responsibility to do it. And then that was the initial reason. And after my first search, it kind of changed. Once I saw like all of the evidence of migration, all those water bottles and shoes and backpacks and all that, it was like, oh, part of this, at least for me, is to sort of bear witness to it. It's one thing to hear statistics and news reports and, you know, but it's an entirely different thing to be there and see the reality and the humanity of it all. And I feel like I need to be down there to see it. And I'm not going to say live it, because I, you know, I'm not living that experience, but to at least get a small idea of what these people are going through by walking in their footsteps. And then I can, you know, I can talk to people like you, and I can talk to my friends, and kind of, and then people who are not my friends, people who are on the other side of this ideological line, and gently or not so gently get in their faces about it. Mm. And if not change their mind, then maybe hopefully try and shut them down.
Yeah. To raise awareness for it, at least.
Yeah.
Like to raise awareness.
And it's good work. I think it's really good work. It's necessary work. I can't imagine being a mother. You talked about Mother's Day. I can't imagine being a mother and then knowing that, you know, my son or daughter is crossing, and then expecting to hear from them and then like never hearing from them. And you don't know, you just don't know. And we've had families contact us who are just out of their minds with worry. you know, and they'll give us, you know, coordinates, and who knows if those coordinates, but sometimes we'll go out and look. It's not something we typically do. We typically don't work cases just because it's usually, and unfortunately, we just don't, the coyotes are not interested in giving out good information because it might compromise their routes and all that. But just the level of panic and questioning that the families have, it's excruciating, you know?
Yeah. I can't imagine that. And you're at least, you're giving them back some kind of closure. I mean, when you find someone and you can identify him with passport or ID cards or whatever, and report it to the authorities, and they recover his remains, and they at least can contact them and tell them, hey, listen, don't worry about him anymore because we got him here. Like, you have closure now, and don't worry. I mean, it's not what they want to hear, but I think it's always better than to hear nothing at all for years.
Yeah.
And we're like crazy. It's a tough topic, Kevin, and I'm thankful that you're doing that. I'm really am, because I think, especially in the US, you have a big problem there. Not only in the US, like we too, in Germany or in Europe, but our borders are not that big, to be honest, and they are much easier to overlook and to see. Like, okay, there are people coming. So I think in the US it's like it's this unbelievable huge country you got there.
Like trying to search it sometimes it's we will draw a line on the map where our search route was, and you're like, it's just sometimes it almost feels like an exercise in futility, because without the evidence, like the water bottles and all that stuff, it would, you know, it's just, the wild thing is though, like every time we go out, we see it. So, you know, we're assured we're looking in the right place, but there's just so many right places to look. It's just massive, massive, massive amounts of land.
Yeah, you know? It's crazy. And even better that there are people and institutions who are doing that job. I never heard of that before, Kevin. I never heard of that before, and probably never a lot of other people never have heard of that, that people are doing that before, that it's even necessary to do that.
Right. Yeah, it's fucked up that it's necessary.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, it is. Like, it is.
Yeah. But it's, like I said, it's, I really think it's good work. It's, and it's also sort of at the same time, it's very political work, and also at the same time, it's not political at all, you know?
It's human.
Who could argue against people doing this? I'm sure there are, you know,
there are a lot.
We've seen evidence of people doing some pretty horrendous things out there. I'm sure those people would have a problem with us, but
what kind of stuff are you talking about?
So there's groups out there that do humane water drops out in the desert. And we've found, so they'll take like 55 gallon, they'll set out 55 gallon water tanks,
in the desert
out there. In the desert with big flags flying up so that migrants can spot them. And we found evidence of them being sabotaged. So one, the spigot was pulled out and then the water was dumped out.
Really?
And one of our friends that comes out with us, he works for one of those groups. They've gone through and tested some of these water drops and they found kerosene had been poured into some of them, which is, I think it's it's attempted murder to dump out the water. It's like, I don't know what that next level of poisoning is. That's just like so fucked up to, you know, people need this water. They see it, it's wet, and then to drink it. That's just, there's not a word that I know of that can describe that. Why someone would do it. It goes beyond attempted murder. Yeah. I don't know. So there's those elements out there, and they're alive and well. And, you know, that's my biggest fear, being out there. I don't care about wildlife, the migrants, you know, border patrol, cartels. The border patrol and migrants is, I mean, not migrants, border patrol and cartels are always a concern. But it's the white nationalist militias that we really,
because you,
that at least I worry about running to out there, because it's shown a propensity for violence.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but the question that comes to my mind is, when you are born on this planet, you are born like every kid likes other people. Most of babies, like you grow up and you normally like people. Where did it went wrong? And where did it went like that seriously wrong that you poison water tanks for people who are starving since weeks, since months? Who are coming thousands of kilometers from all of Latin America, not only from Mexico, but even South America. Wow. Kevin. Yeah,
it goes back to that dehumanizing.
Yeah, yeah.
And our culture is, I mean, at least the American culture is, I mean, all of our heroes are violent people. You know? Like, we celebrate. It's
funny, yeah.
We celebrate, like, you know, our creation myth is based on violence, like the Revolutionary War, and we celebrate soldiers and we celebrate policemen, and I would even consider politicians to be violent people, and we celebrate them, and cowboys, you know, like it's all based on violence, and it's like that's how we solve problems in the United States, is by violence.
Mm-hmm. And violence, and unfortunately enough, violence often creates counter-violence, and then you got your circle.
Yeah, and you know, like, honestly, like, I you know, there's, like, certain types of violence that I'm like, I feel that are appropriate. You know, if you're defending someone, you know, there's other, and then there's the other, where you're initiating violence against people, like poisoning these water drops and everything. I feel that sometimes violence is a necessary thing, but that's a whole other topic that deals with like my morality and that's a whole other podcast.
We could do another episode only about that, I suppose.
Yeah.
Kevin.
Please
go ahead. No. You're my guest.
Yeah, so, and when I got back from Iraq, I like had a big big change of heart about all that stuff, including violence, and I've tried to, as much as I can, you know, I can't do this 24/7, but I've really tried to change. You know, when I was in Iraq, I was a stormtrooper, you know, for politicians and multinational corporations. Mm. And I realized that that's not appropriate. And so I've tried to change how I behave. And that's, you know, that's a part of this work.
Yeah. Kevin, I will ask you the next question and you can answer it, or you don't have to answer it if you feel uncomfortable with it. What happened over there? What happened over there? What happened in the Iraq? find out what Kevin experienced there in the second and final part of this episode.